The following episode of Homer Grown first aired September 5th, 2020. Enjoy. Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street, and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and local producers meant to encourage, empower, and educate gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing experts and garden enthusiasts. Our goal is to provide information relevant and applicable to the broader Kenai Peninsula. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. Today, we visit Sean Jakinski at his farm in Nanilchik, Alaska, and talk about perennial vegetables and seed saving, and why heritage and heirloom varieties are so important. We visit Marsha Rugley of Sweet Berries at her farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska, to talk about canning and making jams. And we talk with Linda Tannehill from the Cooperative Extension Service about pressure canning. Let's get started.
Hello, I'm Sean Jakinski. Here where we're at in Nanilchik. This is Green Cannon Farms. I've been gardening for about 23 or 24 years. The property we're on is Old Homestead property that was owned and managed by my family before the purchase of Alaska. Where we're standing right now is where our potato patch was, one of our many potato patches. Goat barn was right over there. We raised fox. This is a fox ranch for a long time. And I just discovered mink, my father was telling me. We still dig up old fences out of the ground. And we still run into really interesting old middens, like trash middens and stuff.
Are you Russian?
I am. I'm Aleutic. Yeah. Sukhbiak in Russian. Our family was one of the original founding families of Nanilchik. And this is one of the last little chunks of the Jakinski homestead. Hundreds and hundreds of acres, actually, was part of it.
Are there any plants that are still here from that original homestead?
Absolutely. There are. In fact, I can show you right now. We're standing right next to them. If you look down, you'll see these strawberries all over the place. They're just a heritage strawberry. We call them pioneer pinks. That's one thing. And, of course, the native plants, too, were here. And they're also an important part of the diet. We have a lot of, like, perennial vegetables that grow all around us, like native vegetables, like the watermelon berry shoots, really delicious. The wood fern and the lady fern and the pushki. The pushki is edible. We don't need a lot of pushki, though. There's a lot of native currants here. There's five or six different kinds of ferns. We have a few different native orchids that actually coexist inside this garden. We don't do a lot of soil disturbance here. It's kind of what we call like an Alaskan jungle garden, where there's not a lot of disturbance, and we kind of do it in cycles. We start with annual vegetables for a few years. That's where it does get tilled, and then it gets replaced with perennials.
What is this plant that I'm standing in front of?
Okay, what you're standing in front of is a propagation bed, kind of slash production bed of Scorzonera. We call it Walter's leaf. What you're looking at is about seventh generation. And it's a root crop. It forms up these long black tap roots that you can rub the skin off of, and inside is this white root. It kind of tastes like coconut meat. It's really delicious. And the leaves are edible. The leaves are really delicious too. The whole plant's edible from root up. The unopened flower buds are super delicious. The seeds you can't eat, but you can replant. And they sprout readily. In fact, a lot of the time in wet seasons, they'll start sprouting in the seed head before it even hits the ground. The voles will catch them if they land on the ground. So the trick is, when you're growing them for seed, is to try to support them so they don't fall on the ground and get pilfered. And you can go in and pull out the older roots and eat them. And some of the plants that you're actually looking at right now are at least 4 or 5 years old. Some of them are 2, some of them are 3, some of them are just from last year. And there's actually little seedlings in here too. As far as like saving seed, one of the cool things about saving seed is that you can actually select for certain characteristics that you find desirable. Scorzonera, one of the characteristics we've been selecting for is forked root. One, it was just a natural response to heavier soil here. A lot of tap root vegetables like carrots and stuff like that will respond in that way.
They can't get past that hard layer of soil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or in our case, we have this like modeling clay, like really hard kind of blue modeling clay kind of stuff in soil. This is something we normally dig in the springtime. That's also another important thing about growing perennial vegetables, is that whereas with the majority of annual vegetable gardening, you're harvesting your roots in the fall time, you can actually lift the roots and break off a couple of these shorter, thicker, instead of these gigantic tap roots, you'll have these shorter, thicker tap roots, multiple, usually about 2 or 3. You can bust one off and replant that. Not all of them respond well to that, but that's something that we're capable of doing with this variety that's developed over a handful of years here. We'll bring out any of the small pencil ones that are 3 years old. We won't put the small roots back in, but the larger ones that are forking we'll put back in, and that's the characteristic. Plus hardiness, the ones that are expressing like really vigorous growth in the springtime, really solid seed heads and still capable of busting out with plenty of delicious leaf. A good solid seed stock that sets seeds, that overwinters without protection and comes back with that same vigor. That's another characteristic, is cold hardiness and resiliency to weather extremes.
Do you propagate using the seeds or the roots?
Our main method of propagating is through seed. So we're encouraging, you know, the forked, vigorous, cold hardy characteristics, delicious characteristics, encourage that by removing any roots during harvest time that don't express the characteristics that we're looking for, and then let all those cross-pollinate with each other, have them as the main pool of seed bearers, and then to take the seed and replant them. And a lot of the time we'll plant them in flats, and this is one way we can ensure cold hardiness, is planting them in flats and then overwintering them in flats. Any of those that can take that outside of the ground can do it inside of the ground, flying colors.
So you would start them in the fall?
You can start them in the fall, or you can start them in the middle of February if you want. But since they are tap roots, you don't want them in cell packs too long unless you have those really deep cell packs. We do a lot of fall sowing, especially with annual crops, but with the vet crops that we're propagating, we normally like to get starts going early in the spring in February in the greenhouse. But that's what we do specifically for crops that we propagate by seed. Crops that we propagate vegetatively would often be in the springtime. Divisions, cuttings, layers, stuff like that.
Like your fruit trees.
Exactly. Fruit trees, fruit bushes, you know, runners. So next door, this is another bed that we treat much like Scorzonera, only it creates these really rigid stems, and this was the perennial broccoli I was talking about, the Turkish raquette. It's a sweet mustardy leaf, and we grow it specifically for the little broccolis that steam up and are really delicious. We also grow for them for seed. As you can see, these are the seed balls. This is a second generation That's the mama of all of these. She's pretty interesting. She's 4 years old. They've all exhibited crazy vigor. We've cut over 3 harvests off of this. And it's setting seed. Underneath it, you see a bunch of chives. So this is a whole chive, but it's different alums. This is Alum sinensis. We call it flatleaf chive. It's really delicious.
Sinensis is Chinese?
I don't know what sinensis means. This is just a delicious flatleaf chive. I'm not sure its origins or anything. Not a lot of people grow it. The people that do grow it often grow it as an ornamental, but it's actually a really good food crop. And one of the things that was on this property when it was me and my siblings inherited it was a big clump of chives. And chives are often overlooked and underappreciated perennial vegetable that is actually really incredibly productive. These were seedlings that were started last year. They overwintered in cell pack out of the ground and came back with crazy vigor and planted. We've already cut these 3 times. And they'll be cut again this year. Again, when you're like saving seeds, you can select for specific qualities like that, like with the chives. And that's one of the beautiful things about saving seed, you know. That's one of the goals of saving seed, too, of course, is to be able to produce your own seed yourself. And even more than that is to have seed uniquely adapted and prepared to grow in the type of soil and the type of weather and seasonal cycles that its mother plant did. The thing about chives is they can cross between other varieties of chives, but they can't cross with other onions. And that's like one of the great ways to do it, because with the whole cross-pollination problem with saving your seed, is if you, to keep it simple, just pick a single variety of a certain type of crop to grow, then if you want those seeds to express the characteristics of its mother plant, you're only growing that variety, then you don't have to worry about cross-pollination. Not all plants cross-pollinate readily. With this finding spinach over here, this was one seedling out of like 200 that did it here. And this is really delicious. Planting it at the base of the alders with this kind of shaded spot with the nitrogen fixing of the alders, it was just like the perfect place for it. And again, it took 3 or 4 years to even find just one that would do it here. And it's perennial. It comes back every year. And it sets seed. And from here, this is the mother plant of all of the seedlings that we start afterwards. We planted a whole bed over here that got flattened and came back gloriously, just like their mamas. But I think it's really a combination of placement and really luck. Finding that one seed that really does it. And this was the one mama that did it.
Where did you find the original seed?
I got this seed, the original seed, from a seedsman in Poland. And some of the common names for this is Caucasian spinach. The Latin name is Sablitzia taminoides. It's the only plant of its genus. But it's in the same family as, it's like a chinopod. So like lamb's quarters, quinoa, good King Henry, which we grow a lot of. We grow good King Henry for grain. And which historically that's what it was grown for. Here's lovage seed. Do you know lovage?
Oh yeah.
So yes, lovage is just this perennial vegetable. It's really, really sharp celery flavor. We use a lot of it. We have a couple of beds here, but this is the main mama plant for us. She used to actually stand about 15 feet tall and she got hit by the wind, but I just tied her up to the fence so that she didn't get stomped on. But this is a really incredible perennial vegetable too. Super reliable, super productive.
They're really resilient.
Incredibly resilient.
And it's like, I feel like if once you have one lovage plant, that's all you need for the rest of your life.
That's what we thought. After we planted 20 and cut, you know, started cutting them and drying the herb and using it by the handful in soups, we realized that it's something that you can use in much larger amounts than... The beautiful thing about it is one of these vegetables that the more you cook it, the tastier it is. Mm-hmm. So it's really sharp, really intense, raw. But when you cook it over, it mellows and just gets more and more delicious.
It's one of my personal favorites.
All right.
Do you ever sell your seeds or give them to people?
Yeah, absolutely. I've never sold them. I mean, I've certainly thought about it because a lot of these crops, they're difficult to find. Like Turkish raquette and the vining spinach.
Yeah, I've never seen those before.
It's just like lovage. It's a pretty ancient vegetable, and it's kind of lost place in modern gardens just because of different varieties of annual crops and biennial crops that have gained popularity. You know, and honestly, I've tasted a lot of stem celery that has the same sharpness as this. And celery, growing celery here, is like
it's
so
hard.
Tedious. But this, it's like you could cut it like 3 times a year and still get your seed. We have this one big heart-shaped bed of lovage up further in this garden where we don't even allow it to seed. We'll go in and we'll chop the fresh stalks. Next year, if you got a lovage plant, get in there and cut the flower stalks when they've just begun to shoot out of the crown, and they're super succulent. They're just like celery stalks, and you can cook them up. And also the older stems, the old flower stems, you can peel, and on the inside is really succulent and chewable. You know, eventually it gets woody and fibrous, but if you catch it at the right stage, some people even blanch it. You can blanch just setting pots on top of it in the springtime, letting the shoots come up in complete darkness, and it'll be more mild. So you can see we have chickens are a pretty important part of our scene here. This right here is, so this is Chenopodium bonus henricus, Good King Henry. Next door to it, this is Lamb's Quarters, is Chenopodium album. And Lamb's Quarters was one of the first crops back in like the Mississippian culture, I don't know, like 7,000, 8,000 years ago. The mound builders.
It's native to North America?
Oh, absolutely. It was one of the first seed crops selected for size. It was lamb's quarters, sunflowers, and squash were one of the first crops in the archaeological records that were discovered to be selected specifically for seed size, large seed, and thin seed shell. So you can use these, you can grind them and put them in breads. You can cook them just like you would amaranth or quinoa or any other grain. I think it's called technically considered like pseudo cereal or whatever. We'll just cook it straight up like quinoa. It has a little earthier taste, kind of more like amaranth, but it has that same little, I don't know if you've eaten much quinoa, but it has this little tail. It's really delicious. A lot of people consider lamb's quarters like a weed and like a nuisance. But way back in the day, it was, and still is, like all across the genus, is worldwide a really important food crop that's been a staple of diet for thousands of years. And again, it's just like kind of societal preferences and these kind of trends.
You had mentioned a few reasons why you save seed. So you mentioned because the plants are adapted to the climate. What are some other reasons?
Another goal of seed saving is to preserve varieties that are being forgotten about. So heritage varieties, like heirlooms, which I think an heirloom is a variety that's been grown as it has been preserved for over 100 years, 100 years or more. For instance, you know, in potatoes you propagate vegetatively. You can also propagate them by seed too. Not a lot of people do it. That are a plant and replant perennial that have been grown on the Kenai Peninsula for over 100 years that would be technically regional heirlooms because they've been preserved in their little agricultural bubble in the really specific spot in the world here on the Kenai Peninsula and even smaller spots. Beautiful thing, I think there's a lot of people coming to realize how important and how valuable it is to have access to that and to be an active part in preserving and providing access to those varieties. There's a turnip grown in Alaska called Petroski. Petroski is a regional heirloom, an Alaskan heirloom that we had originally got from a seed source in Kodiak that it has been preserving it on their own. It was brought in a long time ago. It was introduced by Russian merchants that would bring it. That's part of one of the histories of Nenelchik is it was actually, as we know it now, before that it was Dena'ina country. But the Russian part of the Nenelchik's history is they were Russian merchant retirees that were coming in that had taken native wives. And the idea of the community was it's supposed to be growing crops specifically to sell to the miners because the fur rush had passed and the gold rush was on. that was the idea, but then that fell through because it was just a bunch of phooey. But in the process, there were a lot of crops grown here, and one of them are these potatoes called, that they call a peanut here, and they're just these little potatoes. And they turn black, and they kind of turn black-gray in the root cellar after they'll come out looking white. You can plant them by the handful, and they finish off really quick. They're really reliable, really cold hardy. We have them coming up in our gardens that we miss in our beds that will come up and just overwinter, imminently suited for the... I mean, there's a handful of different kinds, but I'm personally more excited about, like, perennial crops. With reseeding annuals, I'm really excited about annuals as well, because, I mean, the combinations can't really have one without the other, and there's no reason to have that. You know, it's good to have all kinds of options and diversity. I would say to folks that were like, well, I'm just into growing the food, I'll leave the seed growing up to other folks, that really, in essence, when you are a gardener, you're dealing with seed regardless. There's kind of like this idea, this negative connotation of a garden going to seed as something that's like bad sign or something. I think that people are figuring out is that actually that's a really good thing to have in your garden, is stuff going to flower and seeding. I mean, for a million different reasons you could come up with, like to provide nectaries for pollinators, for providing seed for the gardener to plant next year. Now that there's been so much reliance on like big commercial seed operations, you know, heritage varieties are lost. But it's the same thing with crops like lesser appreciated garden crops that actually are easier to grow, just as productive, and a million times easier to propagate. You know, like there's one that we grow here that's a native vegetable called Brook saxifrage. And it's this beautiful little ground cover, Saxifraga punctata. And it has this delicious leaf that kind of has a cucumber, kind of lettuce-y flavor. It's really suited to shady places. It sends up this little beautiful shoot.
It's like 4 inches tall.
Yeah. The flower will get about 10 inches. And it's something that grows wild here, but really in really specific nooks. But once you put it into a garden situation, it does really good. So not all plants thrive in like a managed garden setting, but a lot of them do. And if you can figure out what they like, you can replicate what they like often pretty easily. Yeah, this is some of the other seeds I grow.
Are these Egyptian walking onions?
They are. And that's something that we propagate completely just from top sets and divisions. To the right of it, I'll show you, we have a big bag of bunching onions. Those are bunching onions. We'll grow our walking onions in beds unprotected, but I've found that they do wondrously well in cold frames. Cold frames are where it's at, if you ask me. My daughter calls them dancing onions because they're so graceful and beautiful. I like calling them dancing onions. This is just perennial garlic. We grow garlic differently than a lot of people. We'll leave them in there 3 years and let them form up a clump and then separate the clump and replant it like that. They seemed to be happier this way. I mean, if you're doing it on a commercial, like you're trying to sell, like it's totally reasonable breaking up the flakes and fall planting them one flake at a time. That's a great way to do it too.
Is this a certain variety of garlic?
This garlic we got from Kodiak, actually. We also have elephant garlic. Elephant garlic does really well. It's not a lot of people do it. But elephant garlic, fall planted in a cold frame, will set up because it's a leek. And it'll set these big rounders. And on occasion, we'll actually get a whole clove of flakes. We really like growing elephant garlic because it sets up these gigantic leeks that you can cut the top off of. I mean, before any of the leeks, I don't know if you've attempted to grow leeks outside, but many folks will tell you that you're lucky to get about, you know, an inch in diameter. And the cool thing about elephant garlic is it's one of the last heirloom crops to be produced commercially, because there's not a whole bunch of different varieties. And not to say that there aren't heirloom crops being produced commercially, but it's one of the ones that have stayed even in the push for all of the hybrids and all of this like modern crop. They give you leeks, but they're not oniony. They're garlicky, the spicy, spicy garlic. They're really, really delicious. And you can cut them and still get the bulb at the bottom. This one is all mint root. Stashies of Finis. And these are really incredibly interesting and delicious. They taste like kind of water chestnuts. And they look kind of like seashells. Again, these are spring harvested. And it's important to get in there because they're just like potatoes. They send out these rhizomes, underground stems, and form their tubers at the end of the stems. But then the rhizomes will die. So you don't have these big stringy runners. So they're a bit easier to manage. And you kind of got, after it's like a 2-3 year thing, after about the second year, you got to get in there and you have to harvest them out so they don't crowd themselves out. But they're really, really easy plants to grow. And you can see they look like mint, but they don't taste minty.
What was the name of that again?
There's a lot of different names for it. The Latin name is Stachys affinis. One of the common names is mint root because it's in the mint family and it forms this tuber. Another one is, and you probably heard this one, is Chinese artichokes, which is kind of alluding to the Jerusalem artichokes, which are a completely different family but have kind of similar habits of setting tubers. So in France, I think they call them crones, and they're a delicacy, and they're really delicious, actually. And this is another one that we don't get a lot of seed from, but we do get seed on occasion. This is called skirret. It's Cium ciceratum. It's the kind of predecessor. This is also another ancient vegetable. It creates this kind of dreadlock of a pencil thin. They'll get thicker sometimes. Roots that are super sweet and delicious, and they taste like parsnips. Skirret. S-K-I-R-R-E-T. The Latin name is Cium ciceratum. This is from Poland, too. You don't have to have seeds to propagate it. It propagates readily from division. So that's what we've been doing lately.
How much of your diet would you think comes from the garden or from...
our own effort?
Yeah, your own effort.
Because we eat animals too. Between our chickens and rabbits that our fences catch, moose and bear, chicken eggs every day, we eat our roosters, the majority of our roosters. They're an integral part of this garden. You can see the way our fence systems, this is what we've been kind of working on, where this is the corridor. And so we're also getting like a lot of manure from them and everything, a lot of compost and stuff like that. And this is literally all washing off into the garden. Also, we do a lot of composting of the manure too, and they're super important. We'll be getting like 30 eggs a day. That's the one thing that we do sell is eggs. So yeah, I would say close to 70% of what we eat comes not only from the gardens, but also from wild harvesting. We do a lot of drying. We do a lot of freezing. I could show you our freezers. It's full of meat and berries. And then we have, I don't know, probably 30 gallon jars of dried greens. We eat a lot of nettles. Nettles are really important green. We'll dry them. We'll do a lot of wild harvesting. We'll harvest ostrich ferns and goose tongue, the beach plantago maritima. Mostly what we buy are like condiments, honestly.
And that was Sean Jakinski, recorded at his farm in Nanilchik, Alaska, September 1st, 2020. Sean wanted the listening audience to know that if they heard any plants mentioned on the show that they would be interested in acquiring, to send him an email. His email is greencanyons8, that's GREENCANNONS, the number 8, at gmail.com. I'm pretty excited for the Scorsonera seeds he gave me and also the Good King Henry seeds. Coming up next, we talk to Marcia Rugley of Sweet Berries on her property in Fritz Creek, Alaska. This interview was conducted in a pig barn. So I wanted to ask you to introduce yourself.
I'm Marcia Rugley. I've lived in Homer since 1973 and out here on East End Road since about 25 years. And I sell jam at the farmer's market.
I'm curious to know a little bit more about your process. Where do you source your berries?
I pick a lot of them, most of them. Some of them I buy. There's a woman in Seldovia that sends me over salmon berries. I just had somebody call and ask if I wanted red currants. So if I can buy them, I do. Otherwise, I'm out picking them. I pick lingonberries up around Soldotna. And that's as close as I'll tell you.
When I first encountered your jams, one of the things that drew me to them was the variety and some of the more exotic kind of flavors. Like, for example, you have spruce tip jelly and fireweed jelly are a few that I can think of offhand. Where did you learn some of these recipes?
Let's see. The spruce tip, there was somebody I was talking to, and he told me that was the best jelly he had ever had. So I just Googled it and found a recipe. Then a few years later, I had a native woman tell me, oh, I haven't had that since I was a little girl, and she was about my age. I wish now, I've thought of her many times, because I wish I'd asked her where she was from, because I don't know who. I would guess probably Athabascan or Tlingit, Southeastern. And then the fireweed, you know, I had seen recipes for it, so I just tried it and made it.
This year I noticed you were offering peony jelly or peony jam, I'm not sure
jelly.
Which one.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any new flavors or flowers that you're curious to experiment with?
I'd like to do rose and lilac, but when they're ready, I'm so busy, I just haven't had the time to do it. Peonies are easy to get, you know, a 5-gallon bucket of them.
What is the difference between jelly and jam?
Okay, I get that question all the time at the farmer's market. And jelly is made out of just the juice, and jam is the pulp and or seeds also. Some things I make mostly jam because I like jam, but some things like the fireweed, once you make a strong tea out of it, the petals just kind of go down to a mush, and so I strain all those out. And spruce tips I don't think would taste very good to eat.
So speaking of the fireweed jelly, I've tried making fireweed jelly in the past, and it always has a kind of green flavor to it. What am I doing wrong?
You got leaves in it. I mean, there has to be no leaves in it. And did you add lemon juice?
No.
Okay, you didn't follow the recipe. The recipes all have lemon juice, and you can make your strong tea, and then when you pour the lemon juice in, it suddenly turns beautiful purple. Otherwise, it looks kind of like dishwater.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yep.
I think I didn't add lemon juice. So do all of your preserves have lemon juice added?
Some things are acid, like, you know, blueberry rhubarb has plenty of acid in it from the rhubarb juice.
I know that certain fruits like apples, for example, have a high pectin content. Mm-hmm. So in order to have the jelly gel up, you need either pectin or gelatin. Is there anything that you don't... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, gelatin isn't something you put in jam.
Is there anything that you don't have to add this pectin to?
Let's see. The butters, I don't. The rhubarb butter and apple butter cook down. And you can make some jellies and jams without pectin. You have to cook them longer, and I don't want to do that. And it's easier to just add the pectin and cook it for 2 minutes and be done, and not be cooking and cooking and cooking. And
do you have a favorite spread that you make? It could either be the easiest to make or the one that you personally enjoy the most.
The one I like the most is the habanero jalapeno, because it goes on everything. It's good on crackers and cream cheese and bagels and cream cheese. And
the habanero jalapeno apple?
Yeah. And I put it on salmon and chicken and pork. And
yeah, I tried it on salmon and that was so good.
Yeah.
Let's move on to maybe how you process these. Do you use just a water bath?
Yeah. For jams and jellies, you use a boiling water bath. And it's 10 minutes for half pints and 15 minutes for pints.
For your operation, do you just use kind of like a standard equipment, or is it more a commercial?
No, I use standard equipment. I just do more of it at a time. I have 3-gallon pots that I cook in, and I do 2 of those at a time. One question people ask me all the time is, do you make jam without sugar? No, I don't, because with jam and jelly with sugar in it, if the seal breaks, which it can, I don't know how people transport it or what they do with it. If the seal breaks, the worst that can happen is it'll get a little mold on it. But without the sugar, you could get botulism. So I am not going to take that chance. And if people want to make their own without sugar, that's fine.
What role does the sugar have? Is it like a preservative or?
It's a preservative, and it tastes a heck of a lot better with sugar in it. And it also helps it set up, because if you just use the regular pectin and go, oh, I'm going to just cut this sugar in half, it probably won't set up. You can buy a low sugar pectin, especially for home use. I buy 200 pounds at a time.
The pectin comes in kind of like a powdered form.
Yep.
There's no jams that you need to use a pressure canner for then?
No, and none that you should use a pressure canner for. There's no reason to, and it just destroys the jam.
I know that you do a lot of other types of preserving, you know, with hunting. I know there's mm-hmm. members of your family that go hunting and do moose, and you have a full root cellar, I hear. When would you use the pressure canner?
All meat and fish and anything that is not acidic. Green beans, you have to use a pressure cooker. Tomatoes, you don't. And I just go by the instructions, because it'll tell you with the USDA guidelines or Extension Service. I use the Blue Ball canning book, and it's a fairly new one. I have one from the 40s that tells you you can boiling water bath meat, which we don't do anymore. And I know people tell me that they do it all the time and they haven't died yet, but that's not good enough for me.
And botulism is one of the main risks.
Yeah, and I haven't heard of anybody dying of botulism in ever, but I'm not going to test it. Yeah.
So I forgot to ask you a question about your jams. Do you freeze your fruit beforehand?
Yeah, so hopefully I can make all the jam I need for the summer in March, April, while it's slow, and then be picking berries and fireweed in the summer when, you know, that's the time to be putting it in the freezer. This year I had a problem because there wasn't any sugar available. So now I am making jam and picking berries, and, you know, I have help.
I've noticed that you sell on the Food Hub.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen you at the Nutcracker Fair.
You are at the farmer's market. Where else or what other venues do you sell your jams?
That's all I do. People do come out here and get it. I have my canning kitchen. They can come to the door and I can give them a list of what I have available, and they just tell me what they want. Otherwise, there won't be a Nutcracker Fair, I don't think, this year. There may be something, but I don't know. But my phone number's on the jars, and people just come out and pick it up.
So I'm going to go back to canning meats mm-hmm. and preserving meats. Are there any dangers with using pressure canners? I know there's usually a list of warnings, and I also know that people have made bombs out of pressure canners.
Yeah. There's a little, I don't remember what they call it, a petcock maybe, a little thing that is supposed to blow first. I have blown one up once. It was the day before I got married, and my freezer went out, and I had all this meat that I needed to cook up. And I had my pressure cooker going, and I set, it wasn't canning, it was just cooking, and I set another lid on top of it, so it held down the jiggle thing, and it blew that little petcock out and blew meat and juice all over the inside of the house. So you don't set anything on top of your pressure cooker and you keep an eye on it. And, you know, I've had my girls can with me the first time. I think it's probably easier just come over and help somebody can. That's how people used to learn to do things.
So this happened the day before your wedding. Was that kind of an auspicious
Yeah, as thing? A matter of fact, yeah, it was.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine that. You're still married, though. So.
No, a different husband.
Oh.
Yeah. It kind of went downhill from there.
Okay. I've eaten some moose stew that you've made at the farmer's market.
Oh, yeah.
In a regular year, there would be a harvest festival at the end of the season, and you would typically provide a moose stew. What can you recommend for people that are, you know, just coming back with their moose and getting ready to process it?
Oh, well, my son shot a moose a few days ago, and he always gets one. So it's going to be hanging for 2 weeks, probably at McNeil. He's probably bringing it in today. It's better if it's been hung for a while. And then luckily that's close enough. He'll just bring a quarter over at a time and we cut it up here. And then I have a small grinder. I really don't want to grind 200 pounds of moose meat. So we'll take the meat back up there to have it ground. Mm-hmm. The rest of it we just cut and debone. And when I've done the stew, I just provide this broth and meat, and then the farmers provide all the vegetables for that end of the season party. I use the lower shanks on the moose because they're really hard to debone, so I just cook all of those, you know, and then pick the meat off, and all of that goes into the stew and make a really good broth.
Yeah, that's one thing I really enjoyed about the farmer's market in previous years.
Yeah.
This year, it's a little bit different at the market.
Yeah, it's a lot different, and we won't be doing an end-of-the-season party.
There's a lot less of the social
interaction.
And also, there used to be the zucchini races, and you were the zucchini queenie.
That was just 1 year. We've had other zucchini queenies.
Yeah, but once you're a queen, you're always a queen.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah. I actually had a cousin I had not talked to in, I don't know, 15 or 20 years, was Googling Homer and fishing, and he found reference to the zucchini festival and the zucchini queenie and emailed me. So we've been back in touch.
Do you know of any ways that the farmers market is approaching creative ways to sort of to do some of the other community-based things that they had in previous years?
Probably not this year. I mean, we won't be doing the music or bringing out the picnic tables or anything. You know, I was hoping maybe by August we'd be able to have the zucchini festival or we'd be able to have the end of the season party, but I'm sure we won't.
So I'm also curious about what are you doing today on the farm?
Oh, well, I spent the morning, you can hear my pig in the background. She's in heat and she's not very happy. loading the van for the farmer's market. That was my first thing.
Is this a typical Friday activity?
Friday morning, yep. Get the van loaded. And then I need to pick green beans. I've been pickling those. I decided the first year I had green beans in the high tunnel, I canned 4 cases. And I really, really don't like canned green beans. So I've been freezing those too. It's pretty much what do I have to do each day. I really need to pick the raspberries here and the green beans. And I wanted to get a few more masks made. I've been selling masks at the market and I have some, you know, I've given away a couple of hundred masks. So there were a few that I wanted to get made for special people. So I'll do that this evening maybe, after I pick green beans and...
Oh!
Yeah. Hi, Dottie. Yeah, she's very interested in everybody, and this is the most excited I've seen her. I mean, I have never seen her do this before, so...
This is definitely heat. I'm going to be ordering semen and AI here in 3 weeks.
That seems way easier than keeping a male pig.
Well, if you can find out when they're in heat. But this is really good. I'm thrilled that she's showing heat signs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still have cows?
Not anymore. I... 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. And so one thing that went was my ability to hand milk. Mm-hmm. And so then my husband and my boys bought me a milking machine. And then I couldn't lift it when it was full anymore. So my husband was having to help me milk twice a day. And I just decided that, and then when the cow's udder went, I decided that's enough, and I'm not getting another cow. Although I may have babies, you know, I have friends with cows that I've taken in orphans, and I keep colostrum in the freezer so I can take in babies.
Did you grow up on a farm or raising animals? Or
Yeah. Until I was 14, I lived on a farm. One of my earliest memories was I was maybe three, and I crawled up on the fence, and I fell in the pig pen, and I just remember this hand reaching down and grabbing me by the overalls, and I kind of remember that, you know, the back, the straps on the back, and Daddy getting me out of the pig pen, and...
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for coming out.
And that was Marcia Rugley, recorded at her home in Fritz Creek, Alaska, on August 28th, 2020. Up next, we hear from Linda Tannehill from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension.
Hi, I'm Linda Tannehill. I work with Cooperative Extension Service in Alaska. I serve the Kenai Peninsula District. And today I'm going to talk just a little bit about canning. Home canning is an excellent way to preserve Alaska's bounty. However, it can be risky or even deadly if it's not done correctly and safely. There are steps you can take to assure your home canned food is safe to eat. First of all, use proper canning techniques. This means to follow up-to-date research-based instructions for safe home canning. I emphasize both up-to-date and research-based. Up-to-date because I've had people bring me 30-year-old extension publications they're using for fish. A lot has changed in 30 years. I emphasize research-based because recipes from other sources might not be safe. Reliable resources include Cooperative Extension Service, and you can find our publications at uaf.edu/CES. Another reliable resource is the National Center for Home Food Preservation. This is a website, and it's full of useful information focusing on all types of food preservation at home. Again, that's the National Center for Home Food Preservation. A second step you can take to assure that your home canned food is safe to eat is to use the right equipment for the types of food you're canning. Here is an example. If you're following a safe recipe for canned pickled carrots, you would process pints in a boiling water bath canner for 15 minutes. Again, pickled carrots, boiling water bath canner, 15 minutes. However, if you're canning just regular carrots, not pickled, the processing time for pints is 25 minutes in a pressure canner. So a boiling water bath canner gets up to 212 degrees at sea level, which is why we can use it for the pickled carrots. The pressure canner gets up to 240 degrees at 10 pounds of pressure on a weighted gauge canner, 11 pounds on a dial gauge canner. You need that processing time of 25 minutes because carrots are a low acid food. Pressure canning is the only recommended method for canning non-pickled low acid foods. These foods are the most common sources of botulism linked to home canned foods. Low acid foods include vegetables, some fruits, milk, meat, fish, and seafood. It's important to have pressure canner dial gauges tested annually before use to assure home canned food is safely processed. If the gauge is inaccurate, the canner might not be reaching a high enough temperature to destroy the Clostridium botulinum germs potentially found in low acid food. If the food is underprocessed, the risk is botulism. Botulism is a serious illness caused by a toxin that attacks the body's nerves. I will be testing pressure canner dial gauges on September 11th in the Ulmer's parking lot. The university requires that I test gauges by appointment only. Appointments can be made in advance by contacting me by email at lktannehill@alaska.edu or by calling 907-283-4877. Again, that's 907-283-4877. This is a free service, and it only takes a few minutes for peace of mind. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of agriculture-related opportunities and other fun tidbits. Now that September's here, it's time for fall soil sampling. This is a great time to get your garden or high tunnel soil tested so your nutrient recommendations come in time to add your amendments before freeze-up and give next year's veggies and flowers their best chance for success. Visit Homer Soil and Water's website at www.homerswcd.org to learn how. If you'd like to try a bacterial and fungal test of your soil, check out Earthfort Testing Services. You can see what they offer at www.earthfort.com.
And that's about it for this episode. I want to thank Sean Jakinski for talking to us about perennial vegetables and seed saving. Thank you to Marcia Rugley for talking to us about jams, canning, and introducing us to her pig Dottie. I highly recommend her jalapeno habanero apple jam. Thank you to Linda Tannehill from the University of Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service. Make sure to get your gauges checked. Special thanks, as always, to Homer Soil and Water Conservation District for contributing content to this episode. I need to acknowledge and thank local musicians Carly Konimak and Kevin Cope for providing our theme music, as well as local musicians Kevin Cope and Ryan Black for our outro music. This show was produced at the KBBI studios in beautiful downtown Homer. Questions, comments, and criticisms can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org.
I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777.